you know, it took a couple of years to get acclimated and for folks to understand that you don't have to be white to hold positions of responsibility.
My guest today is Steve Attenborough. Steve is one of those people where I just think of the words respect and admiration. He is an amazing human being. Originally from Nigeria, Steve, and then you moved to London. Is that correct?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and I had, actually, we drank chai together last week in Atlanta, and I was kind of curious about that as to why you didn't drink coffee. Is the chai something you picked up when you went to London? Is that what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, chai tea generally is, you know, a beverage of choice in the afternoon back in the UK. And after I'd gotten acclimated to that culture, it was very difficult to find good quality tea around the U.S. And then when Starbucks introduced a range of tea products, chai tea was the one that resonated with me. So I've been drinking it now for several years.
No, it was actually quite good. It was the second time I've had chai tea. So it was, I'm from Puerto Rico, which, you know, we're big coffee drinkers, right? And so I was trying to adapt to your culture there, drinking chai with you. So,
hey, you know, I don't mind the Cubano either or café con leche.
And you speak, now you were born in Nigeria, right? But you actually speak some Spanish, right? Where'd you pick up the Spanish?
Well, I just have a good knack for languages. So I picked up, Spanish, back in California, in LA when I lived there for about 8 years. And I have a lot of folks on my staff that are also, Spanish speaking folk.
I mean, you have an unbelievable story from Nigeria, from Lagos, correct? You're from Lagos, is that correct?
Correct. Yes, I was born and raised in Lagos to my early years before I headed out of there to Europe.
So you've got this amazing story. You went from Lagos to London, right, to South
Yes.
Africa, then to the U.S. I don't want to make this conversation about the corporate life. Maybe just tell us a little bit about, you know, that trajectory, and so we can get a framework, and then let's talk about some of the cultural things that you learned and transitions. And I do want to eventually get around to a conversation, because I know you work both with extensively in executive leadership with both Domino's and McDonald's. And I'd like to talk about the differences perhaps in those cultures, but just give us paint a quick broad stroke picture of how a young man went from Lagos, Nigeria to being a very, very high level executive at Domino's and McDonald's. And I guess now you own several franchises with McDonald's as well. So I think if you just kind of paint that picture for us, that'd be awesome.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, my journey is actually captured in a book that I wrote a couple of years ago called 50 Promises. But the headline is simply that in my early years, right after high school, I got an opportunity to work at Pepsi. I did not have a lot of responsibilities financially to speak of, so saved up most of the money I made from that. And off I went to London, United Kingdom, to put myself through college. And the rest is history. You know, joined McDonald's, $1.25 an hour, flipping hamburgers and washing bathrooms. And I was very, very fortunate to have come across a lot of people that took interest in my professional development. And that, over the years, led to successions of promotions across the corporate ladder and took us across the world. So I'm so thankful for all the folks that I had met over the years that have been instrumental in my personal and professional development.
So what was the transition like for you culturally from Lagos? Because how old were you when you went from Lagos to London? How old were you?
Yeah, I was in my teenage years when I left Lagos for London, United Kingdom. It was a very tough transition for me because I had left the African continent but maybe once or twice before I decided to make that transition. And, culturally, there was a huge, language barrier there that was a little bit tough to overcome. But thankfully enough, I was still young and pliable to the point where I took on the British Cockney accent at the time. And, after about 5-6 years, I started, the Cockney phonetics was very fluent. And, that helped with the rest of the cultural transition from there on out.
What were some of the other cultural, I don't want to call it culture shock, because maybe you didn't go through culture shock, but you know, there's a big difference in the Nigerian culture and the British culture, correct? So what were some of the things that you had to adapt to, and just from a cultural standpoint, that some of the lessons perhaps that you learned in that initial transition anyway?
Yeah, so one of the things that I picked up on very quickly was the fact that, look, you know, I didn't have a lot of support. So when I got there, it was very difficult to make friends. The nature of the folks over there is such that they're always very suspicious of you until they know you very well. And even after they've gotten acclimated and they kind of know who you are, still take a little bit more time before they kind of, so to speak, let you in into their inner circle. So it took many years after I'd gotten over the language barrier to be able to socialize, to be able to adapt to the kind of food. You know, fish and chips was the common food, and that was not something I was used to at all back on the African continent. And then, you know, having to have 4 or 5 layers of clothing on was not something that I was used to at all. So, you know, having to wake up very early in very, very cold, you know, climate, and then, you know, moving very quickly to get things done when it's that cold was not something that came to me naturally. But I adapted, practiced a lot, read a lot of books, and spent a lot of time with the locals, and that helped with, you know, cultural integration.
Now, Britain, historically, right, they had a lot of colonies. Was Nigeria ever a British colony?
That's right. That was basically what led to the vision to move over there, because the British governance, you know, although I was very, very young and I really don't have any memories of the British rule in Nigeria, but it made sense for me that, you know, culturally, at least I spoke fairly decent English. And so that would help to kind of find a new life and help me to get things accelerated.
So were you raised in affluence, or were you raised in economic distress? What was the economic situation of your family in Nigeria as you were being, you know, in your youth?
Yeah, my parents were spiritually blessed and financially, you know, had to believe for everything that we had. So I was not born with a silver spoon, and, you know, came out of a very somewhat impoverished background. But the discipline of hard work, loyalty and commitment and respect was something that was infused into us by my parents. And that was the foundation that springboarded me to a lot of the success that I've had over the years. But it's no such thing. As a matter of fact, I was trading on the streets of Lagos at age 12. Wow. At age 17, I was, you know, I got my first job after sleeping on the floor for the first 17 years. And so I was very determined and driven to not let that repeat itself as I go into my adult years. But no such thing as affluence growing up at all.
So let's go back to London. You're studying in London, correct? What were you studying in London? But at the same time, you're working for McDonald's in London.
Yes. So my undergrad was in marketing. So I would my typical week as a student in London was that I would go to school about 3.5 days a week. And the other 3.5 days, I would work about 40 hours. You know, so from the time I wake up, you know, to the time I lived on just outside the London perimeter, and I would have to journey to London about 3 days a week. And, you know, on the third day, I typically would go from school to work. And then, you know, sometimes I would sleep in the lobby of McDonald's. Wow. And then, you know, work the next day and then go home. I basically had to do that because I put myself through college debt-free. And the only way that I could have done that was to work very hard and put in all those extra hours. And so I'm thankful for the opportunity that McDonald's gave me from the very early on. And it was a lot of hard work, but it was worth it.
Sometimes people in America, you know, I've heard people criticize McDonald's, but I think just maybe not a full understanding of the reach of McDonald's as it relates to creating work opportunities, not just for young people in the United States, but for young people around the world, right? And it's a pretty fascinating story. Now you, so you started then to kind of rise in leadership in McDonald's, correct? And then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So how high did you get in leadership at McDonald's in London? And then where'd you go from there?
You know, right after my undergrad, I had worked for a couple of years in a full-time position while I was searching for the right, you know, post-grad opportunity. And then finally, I got a full-ride scholarship to London South Bank University, where I studied artificial intelligence and software engineering. And then upon the successful completion of my post-grad, McDonald's offered me a full-time leadership opportunity. It was just an extended version of the previous opportunities that I've had. And in operations, and a lot of the skill sets that I had gained over the years, plus the academic prowess that I had, you know, gained as right out of grad school, accelerated my personal, you know, progression through leadership ranks. And then after a period of 3 years, McDonald's was getting ready to, you know, develop the South African market. And I was recruited as one of the folks to support the expansion and development of McDonald's in South Africa. And so that was how I exited the UK. And off I went to KwaZulu-Natal, in a town called Durban. And then from there, I spent a couple more years in Johannesburg before my family and I went ahead and relocated to the United States.
So when you went to South Africa, was that, was apartheid still in place, or was that after apartheid was ended?
This was right after the closure of the old dispensation, and you know, it was about maybe a couple years after the old you know, regime of apartheid. And so I experienced some of that, but I really did not witness the intensity of it, because obviously it was a couple years after the old dispensation had been demolished and done away with.
You're a black man and you're in South Africa right after the end of the old regime and the end of apartheid. What was that like for you from a cultural standpoint? Was it difficult in the relationships with white people, or was it not difficult? What was that like for you in leadership there with McDonald's?
It was somewhat very challenging and very interesting. So, you know, I met many Caucasians that are not from South Africa while I was there. So the acculturation with those folks who are not from South Africa but Caucasians was a lot easier, because they've had the exposure to other, you know, countries outside of South Africa. So the acceptance rate was a lot higher. Now, as you interact with Caucasians in South Africa, born, bred, and raised, there was still a notion of superiority and a notion of, you know, you're a black man, you speak with somewhat of a polished accent, I need to make sure that you are the right deal. And so there is always some level of suspicion and cautiousness as they interacted with me. But you know, it just wasn't about the Caucasians either. I think the local South Africans, on the other hand, have not had the opportunity to interact with folks of color that were educated and held, you know, responsible positions. And so they were still somewhat surprised when I showed up and people introduced me as the boss for the business unit that I was responsible for. So, you know, it took a couple of years to get acclimated and for folks to understand that you don't have to be white to hold positions of responsibility. And even when you're black, you don't have to be South African to hold position of responsibility. That black is not, you know, a South African thing. You know, we have, you know, people of color around the globe. And so once we got through the hump of the first couple of years and having to deal with the nuances of lack of exposure to the global world, I think the family and I did very well, and we really enjoyed our time in South Africa. To this day, you know, we still talk about, you know, the fun times and the fun memories of South Africa.
You went to South Africa originally with McDonald's, but then at some point you became, through a series of events that we probably won't cover here, you became an executive vice president with Domino's.
Oh, I made the transition from South Africa to the U.S. with McDonald's. It was after a few years that I'd been in the U.S. that I was headhunted to head up Domino's on the West Coast as a vice president, and then a couple of years later as the executive vice president for all the corporately owned and operated restaurants. I took that opportunity in the U.S. I was just fortunate that when they had opened up Domino's in Nigeria, I was given a special invitation to represent Domino's in the grand opening of the first couple stores in Lagos, Nigeria.
Wow, what was that like, Steve? That must have been an amazing experience for you, just on a personal level, right?
Oh, yeah. That brought tears to my eyes to have my mom, you know, sit in the audience as we, you know, opened our first restaurant. And I spoke about, you know, the journey that led to that day. You know, it was very emotional for me and for those who were aware of my story. Very, 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 very emotional. Yes.
It's amazing. It's amazing. So you were McDonald's in South Africa and Domino's. What are some of the challenges that like U.S.-based companies face when they expand into a country, say like Nigeria or into South Africa? Can you give some specifics maybe for leaders who are listening that if they're going to expand in some of these countries, these are some of the challenges you're going to face that maybe they don't, maybe everything works really smoothly in the U.S. system, but when you get into these other countries, things will shift on you.
Yeah, you're right. You know, number one, you have to understand your market. Understanding the market is about understanding the consumer base. In South Africa, they have a phrase called Sawubona, which is a Zulu phrase for I see you. And a lot of folks that enter that market basically did not even understand the basic essence of Sawubona, which means I recognize that you exist and you are here. And in the Zulu culture, unless you recognize that I exist, we cannot start to have a relationship. And so understanding that and using that as an introduction to connecting with your consumer base, greeting them in their own local language, even if you're not fluent and conversational, you can still at least greet them in their local language. And that breaks down the barriers. And once the walls and the barriers are down, you can start to understand the attributes of that consumer base, the emotional attributes, the physical attribute, the psychological attributes. And you can use that, you know, to market to that consumer base and convert them into loyal customers of your product or your services for that matter. I think a lot of the mistake that most multinational corporations do is they enter a new market with the same product and with same marketing ideology that had been successful back in the U.S. when essentially the culture is different and that consumer base is different. And they missed the boat and spent a lot of money in the first couple of years that's basically not necessary, and they lose a lot of time and traction. So I would definitely, recommend understanding that consumer base and doing a lot of research to make sure that the product has a good fit.
Fantastic. I mean, it's stage one of the six stages of cultural mastery, which is education. And I always say we can't lead people to the highest levels until we know them at the deepest levels, right? And so to be able to step back and take the time to really deeply understand the people we're leading or we're trying to reach, convert into customers or clients is an essential step, right? To being able to succeed.
Absolutely.
You and I have known each other for what, 2 or 3 years now? And the thing that other people say about you who know you as well is that Steve works really hard at relationships, right? So I want to take that and I want to talk about something, because one of the things that we say with the whole cultural mastery movement and cultural transformation is that we'll never transform our cultural realities until we transform our cultural relationships, right? And so everything is about the relationship. So what I'd like to see if I can get you to do is to talk about, maybe give some principles of the development of really endeared and trusting cultural relationships, you know, like with people who are very different from yourself. But how did you get to a point where you could gain their trust? And you mentioned here now on several occasions, it took time, right? But
yes,
I also know you're a process person. And so were there specific things that you consciously or perhaps even not consciously did from a standpoint of process as you were developing these cultural relationships with people very different from yourself.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great point. So I would talk about four things. Number one, you talk about principle and process. So I'm going to roll all of that up into these four key points that I'm going to talk about. Number one, don't burn bridges. Even if the folks that you believe are not a right fit, you know, for you, or just basically not your kind of your people, don't burn bridges. Always leave the door open, because you just never know where you may meet again in the future, or where you may need them, or they may need you. So the other thing I would talk about is just have respect for what people have accomplished and who they are. And you know, respect is not something that they have to earn, because if you give respect, you will also receive respect. And even if you don't get respect, or the folks are not, you know, they don't reciprocate, it's okay, because I believe that respect is a seed that you sow, and it's going to come back and pay off long haul. Number three, find ways to add value to people and in situations. I truly believe that, you know, when we add value, people remember that, and that is another form of seed that we sow forward. And then lastly, don't only get to know the person, get to know their desires, and get to know a little bit of something beyond the individual, and that means their family as well. So for me, those are some of the basic principles of, you know, building relationship that I have maintained over the years. I mean, I have, you know, several others, but for the sake of time, I will save them and not bring them up at this time.
Just so everyone knows, these conversations on Culture Matters, and you can vouch for this, I don't send any questions. I don't prep a guest. They're just conversations. So just you just hear Steve. What you just received from Steve was just a mind that is incredibly process-driven, and that's just over years of experience, right, Steve, where you just are able to very quickly put into a process a series of thoughts. And it's actually quite impressive, because not everyone can do what you just did, Steve. And especially just off the cuff like that. So you could actually write a book right now, the four steps to. So good for you. You moved from economic humility, let's call it, to the C-suite. And now you own multiple franchises. You kind of come full circle. And I know you own multiple McDonald's franchises in the Atlanta area. What's the key culturally? Because C-suite executives basically have their own culture, right?
Right.
What advice would you give to someone who wants to learn to speak to that group of people?
The advice that I would give to that person would be, number one, you know, C-suite folks are very keen on substance. So, you know, don't be overly concerned about the form. Be more enduring and be more specific on the substance. Substance, you know, will trump, you know, any form of, appearance that you may bring to the table, because people will quickly read through the appearance very quickly, and they want to see, you know, the substance that is, you know, that individual is all about. So, you know, and then you got to have, you know, your two or three, you know, mission and vision and your core values completely, you know, owned up and cleared up. So within a 5 to 10 minutes conversation, you've got to be able to project who you are, what you're about, and, you know, what you bring to the table. Those are the things that make C-suite executive gravitate to folks that I believe are winners, and the folks that they truly want to attract and recruit as part of their inner circle.
So two words come to my mind. You mentioned it there, and I want to make sure our listeners picked it up. In the 10 to 12 minutes you may get, right, with a C-suite executive, the two words that come to my mind, Steve, are clarity and brevity, right?
Yes.
Be clear and be brief, because you're not going to get a lot of time. Would you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that. So some folks call it your elevator pitch. Whatever you call it, be very succinct, be very clear, be very sure, because folks can sense folks that are not very sure and confident about what they're talking about, and you can quickly lose credibility as well.
You worked at high levels with both McDonald's and Domino's, right?
Right.
What's the difference in the cultures of those two companies?
Well, I would say they are somewhat very similar in the end when I had left Domino's. I think in the beginning, Domino's was a culture that accepted mediocrity. You know, very sound, you know, product and systems. But then as the leaders within the organization changed and they recognized that they needed to change, that culture changed very quickly through the new breed of leaders that they brought into the organization. They were more metric-driven and they are more results-oriented. And so in the end, they converge and are very similar in terms of cultural sensitivity towards making sure that the shareholder value does not get lost in the boardroom or get lost in the process of what it did day to day.
So I just watched with my daughter and my wife the Netflix special, The Founder, which is on Ray Kroc, right?
Right.
And several years ago, I read a book called Beyond the Arches, which is like almost 2 inches thick. I don't know if you've read it or not. But
not yet.
In the movie, Ray Kroc comes across as a very, very, and I'm going to be kind here just because I'm not sure how else I would express it. He comes off as a very arrogant, self-centered person. And I don't know if it was all about him or all about the brand, because sometimes those are fine lines with founders. What is Ray Kroc revered within the McDonald's sphere, that world? Has that culture continued of where he was very, very driven? And, you know, there's even a part in the movie where he ends up with the wife of a franchisee and she ends up being his wife. And so it wasn't incredibly flattering in some ways. So I'm just curious as to, as it relates to the McDonald's culture today, how tied it is to the founder of the company, you know, Ray Kroc, not the McDonald's brothers, because they didn't really start the company itself. I just want to see if you'd be willing to speak about that just a little bit, because I'm just curious. It's something that interests me from a cultural standpoint.
I think all the positive things that Ray Kroc, stood for from the very beginning are still very evident within the brand today. And I would tell you, for Ray Kroc's era, I think that he needed to be braggadocious and he needed to play up the brand because, you know, the brand was still in the very early stages of, you know, brand recognition and brand building and, you know, brand credibility. And he needed to be the way he was in order to build the brand. So I give him a lot of credit for that. But one of the things that Ray Kroc is noted for saying, and we still use today, is that none of us is as good as all of us. You know, that is a systemic thing. And we always reminded ourselves that nobody is bigger than the system, regardless of how big you are. And, you know, you can talk to anybody. You know, customer obsession is not something that has been forgotten about just because Ray Kroc is no longer here. Customer obsession is still left and center across our organization. The other thing that, you know, he talks about, you know, that I mentioned earlier, you know, regarding that, when I said none of us is as good as all of us, that is still very, you know, resonant today. And we use the word, the phrase, you know, we are better together. That is an extension of none of us is as good as all of us. You know, those are McDonald's values and we still, you know, carry those today. And I don't think we're going to walk away from those anytime soon.
I'm fascinated with McDonald's culture and their processes and the way that they handle their brand. I think it's fascinating. Have you read the book Expect to Win by Carla Harris?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I read that book, yes.
So what's your view on that book? And then maybe since you've read it, I won't actually do the intro on it then. What's your view on that book and what advice does it give for minority people who are really trying to move up within a culture that perhaps is not predominantly minority?
Yeah, I think she gives some universal recommendations. And the ones that stuck with me, you know, very clearly as a person of color, you know, working their way up in the corporate world, number one, you've got to have a mentor. You know, some corporations just don't have a structured mentoring system. Regardless of where you find yourself as a person of color, make sure you have one or two people that you align with and you know they can give you sound advice and they can pull you to the side and help you along, you know, and provide you good feedback. Number two, you've got to have a sponsor. You know, who is that person that, you know, regardless of time of day, will take your call and be able to, you know, regardless of where you are within the company, be able to sponsor you, talk about you, and also, you know, carry your resume across the aisles. And then thirdly, so she spoke about you got to have an advocate. Advocate in the sense that you're not going to be present in the room when decisions are being made about promotability and good fit for an opportunity that may be on the horizon.
So did you have a mentor? Did you have a sponsor? Did you have those people in McDonald's or Domino's?
Oh, absolutely.
You have also, now, just so our listeners understand this, Nigeria is part Christian and part Muslim, correct?
And
correct. You have Christian upbringing. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep.
And so I know that you and I have talked about together, we maybe approach a little bit different, but I know you have a real desire to see broken families brought together, right? And that comes from some of your faith-based approaches and thinking, right? And I know that you, at some point, you really want to, I think maybe it's a philanthropic thing for you, maybe it's a mission thing for you, but you want to speak to that a little bit? And then I have one last question before we wrap it up here, but you're just amazing, man. You're fascinating.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, sir. So, family is the essence of community. And so whatever we can do within our communities and the platforms that we all have to serve, we have to look and seek for ways to make a meaningful connection with the family in our community. One of the ways that we do that within our McDonald's organization is that as our young people come to McDonald's for their very first job, we want to make sure that not only do we know them, we also know something about their family as well. Mm. And it's not uncommon for dad or mom to bring, John to his first interview. Well, after that interview, we take the opportunity to, see John off to the car and say hello to mom and to dad. So they can put a name and a face to the brand that their son or their daughter is connected with. Because when there is a crisis going on at home, we want to make sure that we are aware of that. So that would, help us to make sure that, their son and daughters are basically treated accordingly, or maybe even afforded the time off to deal with any type of family situations. But making that meaningful connection, with extended members of our workers, especially, 15, 16, 17-year-old or teenagers, is very important. Because when grades are not where they ought to be, the parents have the freedom to reach out and say, hey, I know you consider education a very important piece in the development of John. Right now, grades are not where they ought to be. Would like him to take a couple weeks off. And that's fine because, working hours flexibility is one of the benefits that people that work for us enjoy. And so that is how we go about making sure that, the family is a close-knit, integrated part of our community in all of, trading areas and all the communities where we do business.
It's got to be unbelievably rewarding for you having started in McDonald's, cleaning and washing, in the kitchen and all that stuff, and now owning several franchises and providing this kind of opportunity to young people. I mean, it's just got to be super rewarding. I mean, it's amazing, Steve. Just amazing.
Yeah. I am very humbled to have been presented that opportunity.
One last question. If someone were to go to Nigeria and invest there or attempt to live there or be there, what advice would you give to them to be able to connect with the Nigerian people?
I'd say keep an open mind. Nigerians are very, very industrious and very hardworking. Do your homework very well and make sure that you have a very good, selection model for talent acquisition. And then when it comes to your product, spend a good amount of time in the market itself. Don't take the products that you have in other countries there and hope that it would just resonate with the local community. Do your homework very well. And technology is it's on the rise right now. Telecommunication is also very strong. So explore one or two sectors of the economy. Make sure that you have a very strong staying power financially, and then start small and scale very quickly.
So yeah, a lot of people don't know this, but Nigeria has the largest GDP in the African continent. So I think that that's really good advice. My guest today has been Steve Akinboro, who is just, again, nothing but respect and admiration for him. Thank you, Steve. Your story is amazing, and what you've accomplished in life is just absolutely inspiring. So thank you so much for coming on Cultural Matters with me today.
Hey, Ricardo, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, and have a blessed rest of the week.